Okay, good morning. It is now 10:13 a.m. We are here today, May 20, 2016, in the OPA Hearing Room, Suite 907 of the DNA Building in Hagatnya, Guam, for the pre-hearing and motions hearing for OPA PA 16-002, 1A Guam Webs versus Guam Community College. Presiding over the hearing today is Hearing Officer Anthony Camacho and Public Auditor Doris Flores Brooks. For the record, also present from the Office of Public Accountability are Llewellyn Terlahi and Jarek Hernandez. Will Appellant 1A Guam Webs please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Sure. Attorney John Bell on behalf of Guam Webs.
And Rajesh K. Sharma, President of Guam Webs.
Thank you. Will Purchasing Agency Guam Community College please identify themselves and any institutional representatives present for the record?
Thank you. Good morning. Rebecca Wrightson with Cabot Mantinonia here on behalf of GCC, Guam Community College, the purchasing agency, and I do not have any representatives of GCC with me today.
Okay. Thank you. We may proceed.
Mr. Dalkus, could you identify...
Sorry about that, ma'am. Hani Tetsuno is my legal secretary.
Oh.
In case I need something, it's also her birthday today,
okay.
So I figured it'd be fun.
Christina, how do you spell your first name?
H-A-apostrophe-A-N-E.
H-A-apostrophe, or is that a glota?
Glota.
You know tomorrow?
I know when I'm getting in trouble.
Okay. Got it. Thank you. And so the first matter is the motion hearing, and I think there was only, to my knowledge, one motion filed. Is that correct?
That's correct. But we do have a motion to strike that's been filed, but corresponds with the motion to dismiss that we have filed on April 15th.
Okay. So the motion to strike, is that yours as well?
That's correct.
Is that the one? I forget which pleading it was.
It was to strike pages 336 of the opposition to the motion to dismiss.
Okay. Motion to strike. Mr. Bell, is that correct?
Correct. And I kind of assumed that we were going to hear that today. I'm ready to hear that
I'm prepared for that as well.
Okay. Well, let's start as a preliminary matter with the motion to strike
pages 336 of the opposition.
3-6 of the opposition. The motion to dismiss and so what are the I'll just give you the floor on the motion to strike this right.
We filed our motion to strike pages 336 of the opposition to the motion to dismiss the case on the merits. And the reasons that we have filed these are set forth in our motion, and I'll go through a little briefly here, that basically pages 336 of the opposition are in essence a sir rebuttal to the agency report's rebuttal, which is not allowed under the rules. The motion to dismiss clearly moved to dismiss the case on the merits issues and not address the timeliness issue. So the motion to dismiss that was basically assuming arguendo that the bid protest was timely. I'm not conceding.
What do you mean by it? Can you specify your sir rebuttal statement? I'm just not going to assume what you meant by that.
The sir rebuttal, under the regulations that govern the agency report, there's a statement that the agency files in response to the notice of appeal as part of the agency report. Then the appellant is allowed to submit comments on the statement that the agency has filed. And then the agency is then entitled to file a rebuttal to the comments.
That's correct.
And then that's when the briefing on the agency report closes. There are no more briefs, no more filings allowed regarding the agency report. The motion to dismiss that we have filed addresses only the merits issue. One of the issues raised in the notice of appeal was whether or not the bid protest was timely. And with the motion to dismiss, what we have argued is assuming arguendo that the bid protest was timely, let's talk about the merits issues. And the merits issues of this appeal are unavailing.
So it's more of an out-of-scope type argument that the pages 3-6 are kind of out of the scope of the issues you raise in your motion to dismiss.
That's correct. And we've given several, in our papers, we've provided several legal authorities saying that you don't get to, as a matter of common briefing practice, you don't get to address, use an opposition to a motion to address issues that aren't raised in that motion or that are part of a matter that's already been closed. The briefing has been closed on it. And that's essentially what pages 336 of the opposition do. And we've stated in our papers, citing clear places where the opposition just unambiguously says we're addressing the rebuttal.
Okay, we've got that in your your motion is struck.
That's correct. Okay.
So is there anything else?
For
the motion to strike.
Just for the motion to strike.
That's correct.
And in essence, the appellant has been afforded two opportunities under OPA's regulations to address the timeliness issue. And they have provided no authority whatsoever that's going to give them a third time to do that. The timeliness issue has been addressed fully in the briefing regarding the agency report. We haven't moved to dismiss on the grounds of timeliness. We've moved to dismiss on the merits of the appeal, on the merits issues.
Okay. Mr. Bell?
Yes.
Now, this is just your
just
response to the motion to strike.
Correct. Just reading within the four quarters. This is on? Sorry. Justice? Just reading within the four corners of GCC's motion to dismiss, GCC argued on page 3, and this is a quote, despite the fact Longwebs should have known the IFB's contract would be awarded to WSI when the bids were publicly opened and made available February 15, 2016, Longwebs waited until March 10 to file a bid protest. The protest was primarily grounded on WSI's bid submission, end quote. That is a full and explicit argument for untimeliness premised upon the disputed false factual statements regarding, when, number one, when Longwebs should have known whether the bids were in fact made available, and three, based on GCC's unfounded characterization as to the primary list basis of our protest. Based on that part of their motion alone, we were completely right to address those factual allegations in our opposition. In any event, GCC could not leave well enough alone, making it further clear that GCC was not conceding its earlier arguments regarding the timeliness of our protest, even reminding everyone in footnote 1 of its motion to dismiss that its timeliness arguments were made in its earlier statement. Who does GCC think they're kidding and pretending a timeliness argument wasn't raised in their motion? It's actually raised at least twice within the four quarters. As I said on page 2 of my opposition to the strike motion, if we had failed to address the timeliness argument, or failed to respond, that is, to the timeliness argument made by GCC in its dismissal motion, GCC surely would have argued we conceded the timeliness arguments they in fact did make, both in the dismissal motion and in the agency report briefing. And then GCC would later unequivocally prove my point for me. In its reply to this dismissal brief, after GCC just wasted everyone's time with a lengthy briefing battle arguing we have to compartmentalize each and every argument in the dismissal briefs and the agency report briefs in hyper-technical fashion, lo and behold, on page 9 of their dismissal reply, GCC argues thus, regarding whether GCC in fact rebutted our claim of errors in the bid review process, this is a quote, Longweb's mistaken statement overlooks that GCC has addressed and rebutted every material error claimed by Longweb's in not only the instant motion, but also in briefs regarding the agency report. That's an end quote. So after screaming bloody murder and insisting the briefings regarding the agency report and the dismissal must never see or touch one another, and that we are not allowed to address one set of arguments and the other set of arguments, then now GCC is incorporating arguments from one set of briefing into the other for their own benefit. So this is why I accuse GCC of gamesmanship. Whatever the academic analysis of this whole exercise, even if we were willing to pretend for a moment that Longwebs did improperly cross the stream, so to speak, and ignore that GCC just did the same thing in their reply, nobody can pretend that GCC suffered any prejudice. GCC twice made reference to insisting that it should get the last word, and so if that's all that this is really about, GCC should now be placated as it does get the last word in the reply of each motion.
Very well. Ms. Wrightson, do you have any rebuttal to this opposition?
Yes, I would like to point out that our motion to strike is clearly titled a motion to strike, or our motion to dismiss is clearly titled a motion to dismiss on the merits issues. What Mr. Bell raises as far as a legal argument that there was a legal argument regarding timeliness in that motion, that was set forth in the background section. It set forth in the facts. If you look at the argument section of the motion to dismiss on the merits, it only addresses the merits issues. As far as what Mr. Bell is citing, the footnotes in the reply brief, that's exactly what it is. It's a footnote. GCC would not be, that GCC had, was entitled to file the rebuttal under the agency comp, under the agency report regulations. And so by filing the rebuttal, it didn't necessarily resurrect a timeliness argument that it had conceded. The motion to dismiss clearly states, we're assuming arguendo, setting aside, we're not going to address timeliness. We're going to address only the merits issues. And as we've laid forth in our papers, timeliness is not a merits issue. And as far as prejudice that GCC has suffered, I think that's probably, well, first of all, there's been a law cited saying that's the standard for a motion to strike is prejudice. We're moved to strike this argument because the appellant has had two opportunities to address timeliness. It shouldn't get a third bite at the timeliness apple because maybe now the appellant believes that there were arguments it should have set forward that it had not set forward. So we request that the pages 336 of the opposition be struck.
Okay. I'm going to deny your motion to strike. And I will put the decision in writing. It'll probably be out by Monday. Okay. So we will consider pages 336. We will consider the appellant's opposition in its entirety when we decide the motion to dismiss. So on the motion to dismiss, Ms. Brightson, is this is another one of your motions.
That's
you have
correct.
The floor to argue oral argument.
Okay, well, and our motion to dismiss has asked for dismissal on the merits issues, of which timeliness is not one. And there, as far as what's happened here, in the last, as a result of the last hearing, there's essentially two merits issues remaining on this appeal. The merits issues are that Guam Webs has argued that it should have been entitled to a 15% downward adjustment in its bid based on the local procurement preference statute. And the second merits issue is that GCC had not adequately evaluated the bids. There was another issue that was raised regarding WSI's confidential information in its bid, and that has been resolved based on the under seal submission and the confidentiality report that's been provided to the appellant. Now, the standard for a motion to dismiss on the merits is that there are no disputed material facts on the merits issues that have raised by the motion. We've set forth the legal standard in our papers. And as far as the local procurement preferences, the local procurement preference, which is difficult to say. You keep saying it many times.
I know what you're saying.
Okay. Well, what the statute clearly says as a matter of law is that you need an on-island and an off-island bidder. And if you don't have an on-island and an off-island bidder, this statute does not apply. Now, as far as the material facts regarding whether both bidders were on-island or one of the bidders was off-island, the record shows that there are no disputed material facts on this issue. The material facts would be whether one bidder is off-island, and they're not. The material facts in the record, and we've set forth in the agency report, if you look at tabs 5 and 6, I believe, if you look at both of those, it's undisputed that both the appellant and WSI are on-island. GCC was fully aware that both bidders were on-island vendors, because GCC is a client of both bidders. So there is no question. So the local procurement preference, as a matter of law, would not even apply to this situation. Therefore, that issue lacks merit and should be dismissed on that ground. And as far as GCC not adequately evaluating the bids, the facts in the record also are undisputed that GC did just that. As far as the statute is concerned, 5 GCA 5211, section 5211 says that the bids should be evaluated based on the IFB's criteria. And the criteria set forth in the IFB were basically the same as what was tracked by the group that evaluated the bids. And each vendor, both the appellant and WSI, met all of the criteria. So then under section 5211G, what happens is when all the criteria are met by both vendors, you go to the vendor with the lowest price. This is an IFB, this is not an RFP, you don't go through and evaluate whether, I mean, the factor is, do you meet the criteria? And if you do, who has the lowest price? And it's undisputed, the facts and the record. If you go to the agency reports tab 8, both bidders met all of the criteria. WSI was the bidder who met the criteria at the lowest price. Under the statute, 5 GCA, section 5211, WSI should have been awarded the bid. There's no question, the material facts are in the record and on this issue as well. And it should be dismissed on its merits.
Regarding the timeliness issue, I think we made it pretty clear by now that Wormwoods had no reason to suspect any of the grounds for its protest for appeal until receiving GCC's FOIA response, especially in light of the fact that WSI marked every single page of its bid confidential, and Wormwoods had to actually resort to a FOIA request to see any part of it. I'm hoping I don't have to invoke this zombie apocalypse argument to beat this seemingly obvious point to death. I think our point is clear. GCC, as we now know, selected a few pages that WSI approved of, and that's after GCC was forced to ask WSI, given that you marked each and every page confidential, and we got a FOIA request, which pages are really confidential? The fact that GCC went back to ask proves, among other things, that GCC knew WSI did not mark such pages in good faith to begin with, yet GCC failed to challenge WSI's practice as provided under the procurement law. See subsection 3109L3. Just as a quick aside, I'm not arguing that we get it. I'm simply arguing that certain pages that were not confidential were withheld and that prejudiced our ability to find out facts upon which you could appeal. Just want to put that out of the way. Under 3109L3, the procurement officer shall determine the validity of any request for non-disclosure of trade secrets and other confidential or proprietary data identified in writing. GCC was not supposed to simply take WSI's obviously bad faith attempt to thumb its nose at procurement transparency at face value. My point is that this gamesmanship by both WSI and GCC was very much intended to prejudice WOM's ability to learn facts upon which to appeal. As stated in our opposition, after the bids were open, GCC simply said to Mr. Sharma, "We'll let you know." Given what's going on in the news lately with grocery store robberies, just to illustrate the point. Imagine all you see is a security camera footage of a few high school age kids walking into a convenience store and spraying security camera lenses with black paint. Do we know they stole something? No, but I think we can infer that they did, or at least that they were up to no good. Regarding the Pacific Data Systems case that was cited, the issue there was whether, given the fact that there was no factual dispute, both businesses actually met the local procurement preference requirements, did it matter that one of the bidders simply failed to submit their preference form? The court answered no. That is not the issue here. The strictly legal issue to be decided is whether a company which operates on Guam without a business license is actually entitled to a local procurement preference, where only the other business actually has a local license. Now, I admit that my main source for this interpretation is John Brown's learned treatise. Could he be wrong in his analysis that the local preference is a matter of determining bid opening for purposes of identifying the lowest bidder? I have no reason to doubt him, and GCC's authority, as indicated above, is not on point. GCC's own local preference statutory citation on page 6 of its reply reads that Guam can procure from off-island if the court is not more than 85% of total cost, quote, from a business licensed to do business on Guam, that maintains an office or other facility on Guam, and that is one of the above designated businesses entitled to a preference. A cardinal rule of statutory construction is that we don't assume any words are superfluous. Obviously, the legislature didn't think simply having an office or warehouse or even operating on one was sufficient for the local procurement preference. They also require you to be duly licensed. GCC has presented zero authority on point to support its proposition that a business merely needs to operate on Guam for a while, notwithstanding a lack of a license, to gain the preference. That statute clearly has three required elements, the first two of which are one, license to do business, and two, maintains an office or other facility on Guam. To be clear, you don't need a license in order to submit and win a bid, but if you want that local procurement preference, in being locally licensed at bid opening is a prerequisite, and WSI clearly is not. GCC makes a half-hearted attempt to question the legitimacy of our records showing WSI was unlicensed from June 2013 to March 11, 2016, which was the day after our side complained about them being unlicensed, and thus that was Exhibit A to our protest. To my understanding, we are not operating under federal rules of evidence in this administrative hearing, and in any event, GCC tellingly can't produce any evidence from public records that are available that we are wrong. I can tell you that, you know, my staff goes to, we go to Revenue Tax all the time, and sometimes what Revenue Tax is able to produce when we ask for a business license really depends. I know I'm testifying, but this isn't the testimony that I'll rely on if we go to the hearing. But as a practical matter, last week we went to Revenue Tax and they were printed it down, so they can't give us the business license. The best they can do is produce the printout of their system showing what the current licensing status of any business is. But do we really need to drag someone here from Revenue Tax over here to testify? We could produce Ms. Hillary Tobis, the Guam Revs employee who got the documents. But is there really a genuine dispute of facts as to the licensing in the first place? I just don't want to waste everyone's time over this mundane fact unless we really need to. Let's not forget that GCC's own procurement records show that at bid opening, WSI did not include a business license. It's the only unchecked box when they're going through all the documents. Guam Web's further disputes the material fact that GCC thoroughly reviewed WSI specs, what it actually concluded, and why it really selected WSI. GCC has offered vague and conflicting accounts of these issues throughout the record. On page 8 of its reply, GCC, in another strawman argument, claimed on page 8 of our opposition, every single bid spec called for a detailed explanation. We didn't say that. I'm going to quote myself here. It does not take an IT person to see the GCC's group gave full credit to WSI, even where WSI was unresponsive in explaining how it would meet the requirements. I presume we don't have time here to go line by line upon each bid spec that did specifically require an explanation, but I am sure we spelled it out, each specific allegation in our protest and appeal. But per the general terms and conditions of the bid solicitation, that was Exhibit 3 of our appeal, rejection of the bid will be required if the descriptive literature does not show that the product offered conforms to the specifications and other requirements of the solicitation. Failure to furnish the descriptive literature by the time specified in solicitation will require rejection of the bid. In its reply, GCC did not refute our allegation that Ms. Evangelista misrepresented to Dr. Okada that WSI was found to be not only cheaper, but better than Walmart's, and that Dr. Okada relied on this representation in making her selection in the first place. Regarding GCC's claim that as a general rule, courts will not second-guess bid awards, this is regarding the minutia. Well, we're not in court. We're before the Office of the Public Auditor, which does have more expertise than courts do in procurement matters. And the OPA is certainly capable of determining whether a bid was responsive to the specs at all. Imagine if NASA were to put out an IFB regarding the mission to Mars. The specs are to complete the mission in 5 years with a crew of six at a budget of $5 billion. Acme Space Company provides a bid stating its shuttle seats 8 and provides schematics and formulas proving it can do the mission in 4 years for $4.5 billion. Beta Space Company, so this is an illustration, just to make that clear. Beta Space Company says that they can do it for $4.4 billion. As to how it intends to accomplish this, Beta says only that it's...
Well, please stick to the facts of the case.
Okay. My point is simply, exactly. It's you don't need to be a rocket scientist to be able to figure out this company has some specs, you know, it addresses the specs, or this company doesn't. That's all the point I'm trying to make. Second guessing minutia refers to questioning the details. So in this case and under these facts, it would be exactly this program versus that program, the specific details. We're not asking the OPA to do that. We're simply saying that Longweb has actually provided those specs, and WSI literally said we understand and will comply to a lot of the specs. Moreover, GCC provides zero factual support for its claim that the bid review team was made of, quote, IT persons. Even after I called them out on that in my opposition, pointing out that at least two of the five were obviously administrators with no apparent technical background, GCC simply repeated this claim without bothering to offer any basis for that factual claim. Regarding the timing of WSI's bid submission, we honestly still don't know what time WSI submitted their bid because GCC either can't or won't produce the information. We know that Guamweb submitted its bid on time. I have a handout if anybody wants it, but it's in the record. It was 9:30. This is actually GCC's appeal's own record. 0081 is GCC's record, and it's date stamped 9:30. The prejudice is obvious if it turns out, and I'm not saying it is, but if it turns out that our bid was submitted at 9:30 and then WSI had later submitted theirs. If that were the case, then I believe we would win as a matter of law. They can't submit a late bid. Regarding overlooking improprieties being, I'm sorry, almost dead. Regarding overlooking improprieties being in the best interest of the territory, there's no reason to ratify an affirm in a proper bid for a new website. Don't get me wrong, websites are important, but GCC currently has a functioning website during this appeals process, and the world won't end if the new website is slightly delayed because of those darn procurement laws getting in the way. Because there are numerous issues of material fact in dispute, including but not limited to WSI's business license, WSI's responsiveness to the bid specs, GCC's improper review of Longweb's bid, and the timeliness of WSI's bid submission, GCC cannot prevail in this motion to dismiss. For the reasons presented herein, awarding the bid to Guamwebs is in the best interest of the territory, among other reasons, because Guamwebs conformed its bid packet to the IFB and Guam procurement law, whereas WSI did not, because GCC acted inappropriately in handling the review of the bids, because only Guamwebs was entitled to the local procurement preference, and because there won't be any meaningful prejudice to GCC's efforts to redesign its website. Yes.
What are the material disputes of fact?
If you want specifics in terms of...
Well, no, she says the facts are not in dispute. So in your view,
right.
And that's a correct summation of your...
That's correct.
Chief, okay, so what main facts... Okay, are in dispute.
The 50%, whether or not, and that's a mixed question of fact or law, and I was a little bit confused by what she said. I'm trying to understand her argument.
Well, based on her motion.
Right.
Okay, what are the material facts that are in dispute?
When, off the top of my head, when, I still say it's because they made the argument, whether the bid was timely, that's a fact question. Really should is mixed question of fact or law, right? So that's her fact question. As just one example, and in the motion as well, we talk specifically about GCC's, its review of the criteria. GCC, the bid review team, what they said that they found was that WSI's bid was cheapest, right? They said they're both qualified as the cheapest. But then the...
Okay, so timeliness is one. I got that.
Okay, timeliness...
Okay, so you say, I got that in your... The gist of your argument was...
Right.
Longweb submitted their bid on time, and the other bidder submitted at some point thereafter.
Sure,
that's kind of a good. Okay.
Yes.
And then, what's the next one?
Whether or not GCC did thoroughly review compare the bids, and that's where I'm suggesting. And I'm hoping that.
But okay, there's an. Okay, they do an evaluation. Right. We're supposed to number one make sure that the bid conforms. To the IFB requirements. Okay, then they're going to have to do some kind of product acceptability type evaluation. And after that, if that's done, it's just a simple matter of determining who has the lowest responsive bid. Right? Okay, so what part of that process, and I might be missing a step here or there, but then just briefly stating what the part, so what part of the evaluation process do you feel there's a material dispute of fact on?
I think I count honestly about 35 of them in our appeal, and so summarizing it in the opposition, we state that So as an example, it's not just awarding WSI credit where it does in fact call for them to explain to some degree, right? You know, here's the specification, and the response is, we understand and will apply. So they don't comply, sorry. So they actually don't give any indication at all how they will comply. And as we argue, it is required. And then, and yet they get credit for it. Contrary, or in our, when they review WAMWEB's bid, for the same question, right? So here's the bid specification. We need you to do this. And I am arguing the for the terms of the bid packet, it's asking you, at least briefly, how will you do that? To make sure that they're really, you know, that this is a plausible price quote, right? And so we, on WAMWEB's bid, they give very specific, detailed explanations as to how they're going to do that. And yet, at least one of the graders, essentially, didn't give credit for that. So that would be an example of a glaring omission. There's several other material aspects. But again, when was the bid submitted? That's pretty...
We've been through that.
Right.
Just, okay, we got... Okay, so, is there any... So there's some aspects of the evaluation process, and then is there anything else?
I think... timeliness, the licensing requirement, because that's a big question of fact of law, but whether or not...
Did the bid require a business license?
Not to get the bid, but what I'm trying to make clear in my opposition is that those are two separate issues. Requiring a business license to bid is one thing. Requiring the business to have a business license at the bid opening for purposes of the local procurement preference, that's a separate issue. That's exactly what John Brown is saying. He may be right, he may be wrong, it's up to the OBA to decide. But what he's saying is, at least what I read him as saying is, those are separate issues. And in fact, that's what he's, how
okay,
he's
looking,
talking about.
Okay, I'm just trying to understand what your asserted material disputes or disputes of material fact are. So you're saying there's a business license?
I'm saying that there was no business license until the reason WSI got a business license was only because Mr. Sharma here submitted a bid protest accusing him of not having a business license, which was true. We actually, and so for purposes of,
well, did WSI get a business license after they got awarded the contract?
That private, so I'm not arguing that fact. I want to make sure what I'm not arguing.
Okay.
I'm not arguing that he has to have a business license to get the bid. It says that in the bid. I totally get that. You can produce a license upon award. And so that's debatable where they really did, because they really produced the license.
The business license is more relevant to your argument concerning whether or not the local procurement for reference.
Exactly.
Is that
exactly. Because if it is required, which I...
But
which
that's
I,
a question of law. Is that correct?
Well, question of fact. Because the first question is, did they have a license? Because they're debating that. They're saying they had a license. They're challenging our evidence.
Okay. So there is a dispute concerning whether or not they had a business license to begin with.
Correct.
At the time of the bid opening.
Exactly. And so that's the disputed fact issue. Once that's settled, then the legal question becomes, because I agree, there's no problem. If they have one, then there's no point in asking.
Right. Well, I understand the legal issue there, but okay,
sure.
So whether or not they had a business license. Okay, is there anything else?
Just in terms of, and I respectfully submit, this is not just semantics, because I think it's very, very key to the way this process was handled. According to the bid review team, they found that both parties were qualified, right? And I'm challenging the basis for them finding that, but that's what they say they found. They say both sides are qualified. We're picking WSI simply on the price comparison. But then when they relay that information to Ms. Evangelista, who's the procurement officer, and so. But when she relays the information to Dr. Okada, who actually makes the decision, she changes the basis for why the bid was awarded to WSI. She actually tells Dr. Okada the lowest and most qualified, and please don't, I'm not going to try to quote her on this, but it's very clear her language is different.
Okay,
that's
in that memorandum.
Correct. And so I think that's significant,
right?
Because so Dr. Okada is told that.
But there's no issue that the memorandum exists and it says what it says.
Correct.
It's just
right.
Your legal interpretation of the effect of that. Is that correct?
Correct. I think if Dr. O'Connor is misinformed, if it was not true, for example, if she's told WSI is cheaper, then I think logically she's gonna, you know, she might have second, took a second look at the, comparing the bids and seeing if it was really as responsive. And so responsiveness, I think, would be the top. If they're pretty close, or even if WSI is just cheaper, not better, basically is my paraphrase of that, then you at least are going to have reason to look at the specs and look, are they really as responsive, as, you know, which is the lowest responsive and responsible bidder is the test. It's not just the price. You have to look at the responsiveness of the bid. And so, and that's the reason for that, and, you know, for...
But you would agree that the procurement law also says that if somebody has a better product, but they are not the lowest responsive and responsible bidder, the agency has to go with the lowest responsive and responsible bidder. Do you agree with that premise? That's actually the law.
Okay. But that's, I don't know that that applies to this case, because we are responsive.
This is an IFB, though, right?
It is an IFB,
okay.
Correct. So, but you still have to be responsive to the bid. And so if you are the lowest, and I'm just trying to illustrate with the, you know, the NASA argument, which, you know, I understand you don't want me to use the hypothetical, you know, understand because it might not be apples to apples. But what I'm saying is the bid review team, by their own, they claim that WSI was cheaper, not that it was more responsive. But Ms. Evangelista told Dr. Okada, the actual decision maker, the bid review team found them cheaper and more responsive. And that's not true. That's not what they found. I can say that it doesn't make a difference. I think it does, because if they found them, even if they found them cheaper, better is really, I understand what you're saying, is responsiveness to the bid is required. So if they're cheaper, but they're, and for what it's worth, just my interpretation of the law, the reason for that is because, and this is probably John Brown again, at least my interpretation of what he's saying is that if somebody produces a bid and it's really low, it gives you a reason to wonder why are they able to do this so cheap? Are they really able to do this for that price? You at least need to look at the bid specs to see if it really is responsive to your needs. Because there might be some reason why this bid is coming in so low. And so you have to be able to make some sort of evaluation of whether that bid is actually responsive to the IFB. If it's not, if they just say, we understand, you know, yeah, what you said. I mean, literally, you know, you lay out the bid specs. I need a website that's able to do functions A, B, and C, and the lower bidder, you know, just says, yeah, we'll do that.
So I understand
your
argument concerning whether or not that statement about responsiveness to Ms. Okada is true. Okay, so I understand that as a disputed fact. Is there anything else before we go on to the comments? I do have your opposition.
Sure, yes. I'll be honest. I apologize. I'm just not able to, always able to. I think I covered the highlights in my opposition in our argument, and so
I'm just seeing if there's anything else. So.
Nothing that really jumps out.
Ms. Wrightson, any rebuttal?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Okay. First of all, I would like to point out that the argument regarding timeliness, I will continue to object to. I think that they are inappropriate for this motion. It's not a merits issue, and we haven't moved to dismiss on the merits. So for the record, I would like to continue my objection to that. And I understand that the motion to strike has been denied. Now, as far as the question regarding when WSI's bid was submitted, the agency report, and we submitted an errata with revised tab 8, and I apologize that the double-sided wasn't oversight. And if you look at page 1 of tab 8, you'll see a bid abstract for a bid opening that occurred at 10 a.m. on February 15th. You'll see two bids listed that were submitted for that bid opening at 10 a.m. on February 15th. Now, regarding Guam Web's position that there's no timestamps page, I would point out that the timestamp page attached to their notice of appeal appears to have been created by Guam Web's and is part of Guam Web's record. I went through the procurement record that was provided to me by GCC, and it's rather voluminous, I'll admit. I could not find this page anywhere. I would posit that this
Let me answer this real quick.
So, and all of this is immaterial, but...
is there a page? Okay, Mr. Bell, please have it.
Yeah, no, I have it, Mr. Bell.
Okay.
I thought she did.
Yeah, but this was part of... Webb's records, and aside from the fact that it's not material to what's going on here.
Granted, the file is voluminous, but did you run across a... WSI
a timestamp page for
timestamp.
No, and my experience with procurement appeals, I don't necessarily always see a timestamped page submission. Usually, these bids are submitted in envelopes because you don't disclose them, so they're submitted in an envelope. And I think as a matter of legal practice, we often get timestamped received when we deliver documents. But this is not. What matters in the record is that the bid abstract shows all of the bids were submitted by 10 a.m. on February 15th. And again, I would say that this fact is immaterial as to when the bids were submitted because they were all timely submitted. There is no question what the bid abstract says.
What time did the bid opening itself actually take?
The bid opening itself took place at 10 a.m. on February 15th.
So when were the bids due?
The bids were due by 10 a.m. February 15th.
And you had two bids at the time.
That's correct.
But the record should show that.
The record does show that, and that's the agency report, tab 8, revised tab 8, page 1.
The bid abstract.
The bid abstract.
Okay, please proceed.
So now, and regarding the business license and the local procurement preference, I would again state that the law does not require, you need an off-island bidder for this law to apply. And I understand that Mr. Bell often relies on John Brown, and I've pointed out in our papers that John Brown agrees. You need an off-island vendor and an on-island vendor before the local procurement preference is applied. And then we've cited that section in our reply, and I would also point out that the section relied upon by Guam Webs. If the quote had been continued in the opposition, the last sentence of that quote regarding the responsiveness of the business license states, and not to further disadvantage or penalize an off-island bidder. So you need an on-island vendor and an off-island bidder in order for the local procurement preference statute to apply. That's not the case here. The statute does not say you're an off-island vendor if you have, whether or not you have the business license, if you're on-island and everybody understands that you're on-island, the statute just doesn't apply. And as you pointed out, Hearing Officer Camacho, the first question here is whether the statute applies. And that is a question of law. There are no material facts regarding that question. It's a question of law. The statute says you need off-island and on-island vendors. And that is not the case that's going on here. And let's see. And as you've very astutely pointed out, the material facts in the record show that both bid submissions met the criteria of the IFB. Where the IFB required an explanation or someone to describe or WSI's bid submission did that. It wasn't a requirement in the IFB that I could find anywhere that you need to explain voluminously how you're going to meet every single criteria. At certain points, it's fine to say, I understand and comply. And that's exactly what WSI's bid did. And there is no dispute in the record, there are no disputed facts that both bids met the criteria. Revised tab 8 will show you in there that the evaluation sheets used by the evaluation group match the criteria of the IFB. That's what the statute requires. As you pointed out, this is an IFB, this is not an RFB. And an IFB, whatever bidder meets the criteria at the lowest price gets the bid. Now, there is a difference as far as what happened, and I would also point out that WSI won this on a proprietary tool. And if you look at the non-proprietary tool that WSI bid, then its price was higher. And so if W, but the IFB clearly allowed with Amendment 1 that you could submit a bid based on a proprietary or a non-proprietary tool. Guam Webs could have done the same thing. If they had, Guam Webs had a proprietary tool, it could have submitted a bid based on a proprietary tool. It didn't. It submitted a bid based on a Drupal development tool, which was the same as WSI's bid based on Drupal. And Guam Web was actually under, about $1,000, $1,300 under WSI. So if the bid had required use of a non-proprietary tool, Guam Webs would have won it. But the bid didn't require that. The bid said you can submit based on your proprietary tool. WSI did that. WSI's proprietary tool was $12,000 less. It met all of the criteria and it was $12,000 less.
Was that their total bid or just the tool part of it?
The proprietary tool bid. The grand total on that bid was $87,900. And I've set forth the charts in our motion to dismiss that outlines.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's in there also.
Okay.
Got me a little confused there versus kind of putting in the price or the whole thing.
Yeah, the bid in its entirety.
It's $12,000 cheaper.
Was $12,000 cheaper. Which is not a significant amount of money necessarily, but it's enough. Under the statute, under the, what's required, it's the lowest bid. It's $12,000. It was $12,000 lower. So we would again submit that there are no material facts in dispute here. The record clearly speaks for itself. The law speaks for itself. Based on the record and the law, there are no material facts in dispute, and on the merits, this appeal fails. And we would respectfully request that you grant our motion to dismiss on the merits.
I'm going to take this motion to dismiss under advisement and likewise issue a written decision. And
yes, I have a few questions. All right. Ms. Wrightson,
yes.
A couple of things. I was just curious if you know why GCC decided to make this as an IFB as opposed to an RFB.
And I do not know the answer to that question, and I also wondered, because it does seem like a certain, you know, it could be amenable to an RFP.
Correct, yeah. Uh-huh.
And I think that they were very, they knew what they wanted, I guess, and so there wasn't much discussion, and if you could meet the requirements of what they wanted.
The reason I say this is because when we went out for our website, we went out on an RFP, and,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fundamental thing that we go by is, are you buying brain power? And I would think the development of a website is brain power
mm-hmm.
because it's not like you're saying sweep the floors twice a week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe afterwards the maintenance might be considered routine services, but do you know, so you have
Yeah, I have no idea, and I would agree that this sort of bid would be amenable to an RFP.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that there was any error in doing it under an IFB. But you could then allow yourself to have them conversations with the bidders and conduct interviews and get a little more
so
in-depth.
So you don't think that this is an improper source of method of solicitation?
I don't believe that it is an improper method of solicitation.
Why?
Because an IFB, when you're purchasing a product and you're purchasing a website, and so the end result would be a product.
Well, in the end result in an audit, there's a product, a report, but that's an RFP.
I would agree that, yes, so that would be an end result. And whether or not you're actually producing it.
And in architectural services, the end product are the designs.
That's correct. And I guess I don't necessarily see where it would be an error using an IFB rather than an RFP.
The other issue that I would like for you to go to is on page, in your agency report on tab 7, under item number 4. Bidders are cautioned under licensing. Bidders are cautioned that the college will not consider for award any offer submitted by a bidder who who has not complied with the Guam licensing law. So, what is your interpretation of that? If Mr. Bell's comment and is correct that WSI did not have a license prior to March, you know, there was a gap, would they have complied with the Guam licensing law if they were a local company?
I would say yes, that they would have. They're a local company. They're on island. They've been established on island for over a decade. They're a client of GCC. We've set forth in our papers where that's located in.
You said they've been your client for over a decade, or has been.
They've been on island for over a decade.
Okay.
And they have been a client of GCC.
Okay.
As well, along with Guam Webs.
Are they currently, were they a client in 2014, do you know?
I believe so, yes, because they are the current host.
You mean vendor?
Current vendor, yes.
Okay,
they are the current, because they are the current host of GCC's website.
Oh, they are the current
host.
That's
correct.
Well, is that after the IFB award here, or the
previously,
before
that?
Do your records show that they have a license?
I would have to check with GCC and find out what their internal records show.
Previous. Because I'm puzzled, Mr. Bell. Your comment raised some questions of facts. Because you're saying that WSI did not, the last time they had a license was 2013. And then the next time they had a license was not until March of 2016. So there's a gap here. And then going back to you, Ms. Wrightson, if you've been doing business with GC or with if WSI has been a vendor for several years, does your record show that they are a valid license, validly license in Guam?
And I don't know exactly what GCC's internal records would show.
I
apologize. I needed counsel's advice on my questioning on this thing. I'm confused now. All right. So what I heard you say is that WSI has been a vendor for with GCC for the last.
They've been on island for the last 10 years, and they are the current host of GCC's website.
And they're the current host.
And that's, I've cited in our papers where in the record that's been established. And the same for Guam Webs is also a client of GCC, and there's no question that they are an on-island vendor.
Okay.
So in situations such as that, when you're dealing with two on-island bidders, as a matter of law, the local preference statute does not apply.
Okay. All right. I'll defer to my counsel on the issue of the licensing. All right,
yes, yeah, and I would just point out that upon award was when the business license
right.
was required to be
right.
supplied.
Okay. That's all. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and like I said, this will be under advisement and issue a decision in writing. Now, Mr. Bell, you look like you had something to say.
Oh, it's just, it's a matter of law, so I know my clients understand. They've got questions for me saying, but it's a legal decision,
okay.
a legal matter to be decided.
Going to the next phase of today's hearing, which is the actual pre-hearing conference. Of course, this assumes that we don't grant Ms. Wrightson's motion. We still have to do the housekeeping for timing purposes, essentially. So if we proceed to a hearing, I think you filed your request for hearing.
Yes, sir.
All right. And did GCC file a request for hearing?
We filed a notice of non-request, or however
okay,
you'd
so
like to.
Wanna,
yeah,
right,
the,
so
yeah, we don't believe that the hearing is necessary.
So GCC is not requesting a hearing. Mr. Bell, your client does have the option of foregoing a hearing and having us decide the case based on the record filed with the OPA. That's just an option if you persist with your request. And assuming we don't grant the motion to dismiss, does your client still want it here?
Yes, and it's, okay. I don't mean to gloss over, because in terms of getting into the technical details of the bid review process, that's why we're requesting one, just to be clear on that, is in a motion hearing, it's hard to really explain the factual basis for what specifically we're complaining of and what we are asking to review, and I just think that's more feasible to do that in a hearing.
And the main question is, how many witnesses are you expecting to call if we have a hearing?
For your order, I do have my housekeeping notes that and things, points of discussion. As many as, and depending on, and that's part of what the order was for housekeeping purposes, do we really need to fight over timeliness? Do we really need to fight over whether WSI had a business license? It'd be great if we could settle those issues. I totally understand if, opposing counsel doesn't want to settle that right now. But as many as it would be Mr. Sharma, he would be the main person.
Just you don't have to give your witness list down. Those are a day for this town. I'm just looking for numbers and trying to gauge how
seven,
long it'll take.
Seven grand total. I think it's
seven.
Five, six, seven, maybe eight. Sorry.
Okay, 7 to 8 witnesses.
Yes.
Ms. Wright, how many witnesses would you be planning on calling if we had a hearing?
Well, the witnesses that I would call, and of course, you know, Mr. Bell and I may be calling the same witnesses.
So approximately, his same witnesses, 8 witnesses or so.
I would probably have 7 or 8 as well, if we're going to end up discussing I would assume. I mean, I would call the evaluation group and the procurement. I would and the procurement officers. And if Mr. Bell does not call them,
are those the same? Same 8 people you're planning on calling?
Basically, right. The only I think the only witness that I would call that wouldn't be the obvious witness would be Ms. Tovis. She was the one that went to Revenue Tax to get the documentation, to the extent that that there was really a dispute or a continued dispute about when and whether WSI had business license.
So we're looking at 2 days up here. And are the parties available for June 9th and 10th?
And this would be assuming that the motion to dismiss would be denied?
No. That's if it's denied. Like I said, it's still under advisement, but clearly if we grant your motion, part of the motion will be vacating these dates.
Okay, but the motion to dismiss will be decided before we do the evidentiary.
That is correct.
And I am available for the record, as is my client, June 9th and 10th.
I can be available June 9th and 10th. I would need to check with my witnesses, I guess.
Are the parties, instead of the 9th and 10th, are the parties available on June 8th and 9th?
And I can be available on those 2 days. And I
I can skip something that was optional for me on the 8th. It's a good point with the witnesses. At least the main witness here, I guess, is available. I guess it would be GCC's personnel. You know, I don't know if they're on leave, but no problem with the 8th or the 9th.
All right. And yeah, I do encourage the parties to have discussions before the hearing, and yes, so there are facts you can stipulate to that would make it a faster hearing. Then certainly you can submit a list of those stipulations so we don't have to go over them, and they'll be taken as facts for the hearing. And are there any, I'll also be issuing essentially a scheduling order based on the June 6th and 9th dates for the hearing. 8th and 9th. That will give deadlines to file your witness list, your respective hearing briefs, so on and so forth, based on those hearing dates. And are there any, at this time, from either party, are there any protracted issues that you foresee that might come up at the hearing?
I do, because I just want to ask, you know, on the record, just because it may save time, if there's an objection to the sufficiency of the evidence regarding the license, I just want to know what is, if you have an idea in terms of what you would want to see that you would accept as proof?
Well, the question about the evidence that was submitted was dropped in a footnote, so GCC has never argued that. Anyway, and I understand that the rules of evidence do not apply here. And so as far as the authenticity of the paperwork that was attached to the motion, I suppose something from the Department of Revenue Tax saying we printed this report.
Okay. Well,
instead of just attaching 2 random pages that could have been generated from any computer anywhere.
Yeah, we might require a little bit more than that. And in terms of the procurement record itself and the pleadings, you need not create an entire duplicate procurement record and try to enter that into evidence. Essentially, everything that's been filed is part of the record. You can cite to it. Your exhibits should be limited to those documents which you plan on presenting to your witness. And that's more for us to keep a good hearing record, so we know exactly what document you are showing to the witness. If you're not planning on showing a document to the witness, you don't need to include that as an exhibit. And certainly if it's already on file as part of the procurement record or as part of the pleadings, either as in the pleading or exhibit to the pleading. Does anybody have any questions about that?
I think it's
just trying to save some trees.
Sure.
I appreciate that. Yeah, there's been a lot of trees killed in this so far.
And then finally, at this time, are there any persons that either side plans on calling that might need any special accommodations to participate in the hearing?
Not to my knowledge.
No. I mean,
all right. But the order will say if you come across that issue, it'll have a point of contact with the OK to make those arrangements so we make sure that they can adequately participate in the hearing. Are there any other issues that we need to bring up at this time?
None from us.
I do not have any.
All right, so I plan on, I don't know about today, but definitely by Monday, at least getting out the notices for the hearing as well as the scheduling order for that hearing. And we still owe a decision for both the motion to strike, which was denied, and the motion to dismiss, which I hope to get out before next week Wednesday. All right. No. And we are off the record at 11:30.